Hello, this is David Duke, and this is the audio version of my book, My Awakening, A Path to Racial Understanding. The next part is part three, The Jewish Question. And this part is a very essential part of this book. It deals with my awakening to the threat of Jewish extremism. We all hear a lot about the threat of Islamic extremism, of Christian extremism, even white extremism. We don't hear about the threat of Jewish extremism. And for those who don't know much about this issue, I really urge you to have an open mind, listen to my words, and more importantly, listen very carefully to the words of mainstream, powerful Jewish leaders who themselves talk about their agenda, and they expose how their agenda is one that's in conflict with both the American people and really the interest of many, many people in the world. I think you'll find this section of My Awakening to be very enlightening and very powerful. We begin with chapter 14, entitled simply, The Jewish Question. In the first years of the 21st century, any serious criticism of the Jewish people, their religion, or the nation of Israel is considered the worst of moral crimes. Jews are the most sacred of sacred cows, and anyone with a negative word about them inevitably finds himself labeled an anti-Semite. Once a man acquires that label, true or not, nothing can redeem him from what the mass media views as the ultimate sin. So irredeemable as I am, I have the freedom to write and speak openly about a taboo that few dare to broach. You see, I'm not an anti-Semite, and I reject that epithet. However, I must address what Henry Ford called the world's foremost problem, a problem not only vital to the Palestinian people, but also to every other nation of the world. It's almost impossible in our Holocaust-saturated world to even say the word Jew without arousing emotion. The mass media of the Western world have made that so with their unrelenting packaging and repackaging of the Holocaust. As British historian David Irving says, it's spelled Holocaust with a capital H. Trademark applied for. The Holocaust has gone from being a sidebar of the Second World War to the point where the war has become an historical footnote to the Holocaust. During the 1 year before the publication of my autobiography, My Awakening, which was well over 50 years after the end of the war, my local, and local is a misnomer, for New Yorkers own it, my local newspaper, the Times-Picayune, had dozens of news and feature articles exploring varying aspects of the Holocaust. In that year, the same paper had barely mentioned the Soviet gulags, where between 10 and 30 million people died, and had only one story that mentioned the Cambodian murder of 3 million. Not a single article appeared about the slaughter of 30 to 40 million in Red China. Looking through old newspaper microfiche, I discovered that during the late 1990s, there were at least 10 times more news articles about the Holocaust than there were in the late 1940s or 1950s. Rarely does an event become more talked about and written about as it recedes in time. For instance, the subject of the Second World War took up a far greater proportion of movies, TV programs, documentaries, books, and magazine articles in the late 1950s than in the early days of the 21st century. Not so for the Holocaust. The further in time we seem to get away from the event, the more it bludgeons us as the Holocaust industry expands. It would be a Herculean task to even count all the Holocaust-oriented television news stories and specials, the documentaries and docudramas, the books, both fiction and nonfiction, the magazine articles and plays, the movies, tales of Holocaust victims, relatives, survivors, war crimes, criminals, reparations, Holocaust-related art and literature, remembrances and memorials, bombard us almost daily. The sheer weight of this onslaught has prompted a number of Jews to call it Shoah business. The Holocaust Museum is located right in the most sacred soil in the American Pantheon, the Mall, near the Smithsonian Institution, financed in no small part by our tax dollars. Interestingly, it was built long before there was any real effort to build a memorial to the Second World War. It is a massive, modern version of the Chamber of Horrors at Madame Tussaud's Wax Museum. The Holocaust is not the only Jewish trauma for which we all must grieve. For we see many painful historical accounts and dramatic Hollywood productions about other historical persecutions of the Jews. Jews are victimized by Arab terrorists in the Mideast, by fascists in Europe, even by Klansmen in the United States. A seemingly inexhaustible supply of books, articles, movies, and plays concern individual Jews who have suffered from evil anti-Semites. Each year, tens of thousands of stories about intelligent, compassionate, unselfish, creative, moral, and courageous Jews fill 2-foot TV screens and 30-foot movie screens, our newspapers, magazines, and books, our playhouses, pulpits, and podiums, our radio waves and satellite transmissions. There are thousands of portrayals of persecuted Jews as innocent, noble, and heroic, while their opponents are portrayed as the embodiment of evil. No group on earth has better public relations than do the Jewish people. Whether it is Pharaoh's army with swords unsheathed chasing the Hebrews, or the Tsar with his anti-Semitic Cossacks, Hitler with his SS minions dressed in black, an unnamed Palestinian terrorist trying to kidnap Israeli school children, or the more intimate story of a sensitive Jew mistreated by anti-Semitic businessmen, we have all seen the anti-Semitic stereotype. We've seen the skeletal bodies and shared the Jewish pain. I know of this firsthand, for it was true for me as a young man. At age 12, reading Anne Frank, Diary of a Young Girl, in the school library, I recoiled from the inhumanity of anti-Semitism. By the time I had finished the book, I felt as if I had lost members of my own family. With my shirt sleeves, I covertly wiped away the moisture that had welled up in my eyes. Only a few times did I have any discussion with my father about Jews, for whom he had only praise. He spoke about my great uncle Nathan, a Methodist minister, who had converted from the Jewish faith and married my grandfather's sister, my great aunt Gussie. Father had enormous respect for Nathan and carried it over to the rest of the people he called the, quote, Hebrews. Thinking that his term carried more dignity than the word Jews, at various times he described the Hebrews as hardworking, smart, thrifty, and accomplished. Thrifty was an accolade that made a distinct impression on me because I knew that Father looked upon that particular trait as one of the most important. He hated waste of any kind. I learned that lesson at the dinner table 100 times, having to eat every bite of my food before being excused. I thought thriftiness was a Scottish tradition, but hearing that it was Jewish impressed me. Recitals of the Holocaust and Bible stories form my primary impressions of the Jewish people. Cecil B. DeMille's movie classics, such as typified by the Ten Commandments, led me to identify contemporary Jews with heroic Israelites of the Old Testament. I formed a deep admiration for the chosen people. How, then, did I go from my early fawning opinion of the Jews to being eventually described as a dangerous anti-Semite by the powerful Jewish advocacy organization, the ADL, the oddly named Anti-Defamation League of B'nai B'rith? No Jew had ever overtly wronged me. I wasn't taught anti-Semitism by my parents or friends, nor did I blame them for the crucifixion of Jesus Christ. Although I categorically reject being labeled anti-Semitic, I certainly believe that, as any other people, Jews deserve praise for their accomplishments, and conversely, they should not be immune from criticism for their failings. The only problem is that in post-World War II, Holocaust-saturated America, any criticism of Jews as a group is viewed as the moral equivalent of condoning mass murder. If one criticizes any part of Jewish history or conduct or intolerant aspects of their religion, or even Israel's Zionist policies, he inevitably acquires the label anti-Semitic, a term that could not be more damaging or prejudicial. If one speaks, however, about the routine mistreatment of Indians in American history, he is not viewed as anti-American. Those who express horror about the excesses of the Spanish Inquisition are not labeled anti-Christian or anti-Spanish. The same media that prohibits even the slightest criticism of Jews has no reluctance to demean other groups, white Southerners, Palestinians, Germans, and fundamentalist Christians and fundamentalist Muslims. These groups get more than their share of ridicule and debasement. The portrayal of the slack-jawed, green-toothed, ignorant, racist, hateful, murderous, rural white Southerner has become a stereotype in Hollywood films. White Southerners are not alone. One recent best-selling book is the media-promoted Hitler's Willing Executioners, a book that says the German people have something dark and evil within them, an inherent defect that makes them all guilty for the atrocities of the Holocaust. In Europe today, there are so-called hate laws that can land one in jail for saying anything critical of the Jews. In fact, there are hundreds of men who have been jailed for simply raising historical questions about the Jewish version of the Holocaust. These scholars do not allege that Jews are evil. They simply use scientific and historical evidence to dispute prevailing historical interpretations of the persecution of Jews during the Second World War. For simply offering a different historical analysis and opinion, many European scholars, such as David Irving, Dr. Robert Farrison, and Jürgen Graf, have been prosecuted. On the other hand, Daniel Goldhagen, the writer of Hitler's Willing Executioners, a man who argues that Germans are inherently evil, is not persecuted for racial defamation. He is celebrated. Of course, the Arab terrorist is now a staple of Hollywood movies. In stark contrast, whenever Jews are mentioned as a group, it's always with a sort of hushed reverence. What is it about the Jewish people that evokes such unrestrained adulation and visceral hatred? Once I became convinced that people of European descent, and truly all people, have the right to protect and preserve their heritage and culture, I became a young member of the Citizens Council. Often, after class, on rainy summer days, I would go down to the office on Carondelet Street in New Orleans to do volunteer work. Many fascinating publications streamed into the office from hundreds of right-wing groups all over America. One day, as I finished helping with the council mailing, I came across some tabloid newspapers called Common Sense. It was a conservative, right-wing paper modeled after Thomas Paine's classic broadside. But the message was sharply different than Paine's. One issue's headline read, "Communism is Jewish," and another trumpeted, "NAACP, part of Red Master Plan." I also found some old issues. The huge headline in one of them predicted Red Dictatorship by 1954. However, such a warning did not seem too credible when I looked at it in 1965. I found the National Enquirer-type headlines ludicrous, but it was hard to resist reading something that scandalous, even just to laugh at it. One of the regular volunteers, Maddie Smith, an elderly lady in a flower print dress and outlandish hat, saw me snickering at the lurid headlines and simply said, "You know, it's true." "Red Dictatorship by 1954? I replied with a smile. "No," she said. "Communism is Jewish. They are the ones behind it." I thought I would humor the little old lady by politely arguing a bit with her. "Ma'am, how could that be?" I asked. "Communists are atheists. They don't believe in God. Jews believe in God, so how could they be communists?" "Do you know who Herbert Aptheker is?" she said, answering my question with one of her own. "No," I replied, affecting nonchalance. She was like a tightly coiled spring waiting for release. "He has the official role of the chief theoretician of the Communist Party USA, and he's listed in Who's Who in World Jewry. Leon Trotsky, the communist who took over Russia with Lenin, was in Who's Who in American Jewry. His real name is Lev Bronstein. Both are atheist communists, and both are proudly listed as great Jews in these books published by the leading rabbinical organizations of the world. Meekly I offered, well, maybe they were listed because they were once Jews. You have so much to learn, she said with a sigh. Under Israel's law of return, you can be an atheist communist and still immigrate to Israel. And there are plenty of them, too. You only qualify to immigrate if you are a Jew, and a Jew is described simply as being of Jewish descent. So you see, you can be Jewish and still be an atheist and still be a communist. And I tell you, communism is Jewish. All Jews are communists, I retorted sarcastically. No, 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 she emphatically replied with much patience in a way that she paced her words. All Jews are not communists any more than all snakes are poisonous. But most leading communists in America are Jews, as well as most of the convicted Russian spies in America, as well as the leaders of the New Left, and historically, most of the commie revolutionaries in Russia were Jewish as well. What Mrs. Smith said made me very uncomfortable. Although it was not yet time to leave, I claimed that I had to catch my bus back home. I left the office hurriedly. Mrs. Smith had to be wrong, but I just did not have the information I needed to refute her statements. I resolved to research the issue so that I could show her why she was wrong. Something else bothered me as well, for I felt a little guilty for even talking with someone who said such terrible things about Jews. I was staunchly anti-communist, and to suggest that Jews were behind the horrors of communism was to me such a terrible allegation that my heart told me that it just could not be true. It was the first time I had been face to face with a person I presumed was an anti-Semite, and I was soon running to catch my streetcar. During the next couple of days, I avoided even thinking about the issue, and I stayed away from the Citizens Council office. Finally, I picked up and read the two copies of Common Sense I'd taken home. One copy maintained that the NAACP was a communist front organization dedicated to the eventual overthrow of our way of life. It purported that 12 Jews and one African-American had founded the NAACP, and that all the founders were dedicated Marxists with decades of documented communist affiliations. The article asserted that the only major black founder of the NAACP, W.E. Du Bois, was an avowed member of the Communist Party who immigrated to communist Ghana, where he eventually was buried. Furthermore, the scandalous publication purported that the NAACP was financed by Jewish money and always had a Jewish president. It said that a Jew, Kitty Kaplan, was the current NAACP president, and that he was the real leader of the organization rather than its African-American frontman, Roy Wilkins. Although the public perceived Wilkins as the NAACP leader, the paper asserted that he actually had the lower rank of national secretary. The argument of Common Sense was that the Jews led and supported the integrationist NAACP because they were opposed to powerful African-American nationalist leaders such as Marcus Garvey and later those who led the Nation of Islam. Is it said that they really have no interest in African-Americans becoming self-reliant or self-supportive? It maintained that the Jewish leadership had an interest in racial pluralism, diversity, and conflict only because it would offer certain advantages to the Jews as a group. The other copy of Common Sense was no less startling. It had a long article asserting that international communism was a Jewish creation and that the Russian Revolution had not really been Russian at all. Jews had supposedly financed and led communism since its inception, and that they still thoroughly dominated the communist movement in the United States and around the world. This National Enquirer of the Right quoted many names, dates, and sources to support its incredible allegations. I was very skeptical of his assertions, but the information was too compelling to ignore. I had learned early on not to easily dismiss unpopular opinions. Despite the article's strong documentation, the allegations seemed too bizarre to be true. How could it be that the largest and most powerful African-American organization in America had been founded, financed, and run by Jews and Marxist Jews at that, instead of African-Americans? How could something so incredibly amazing be kept so quiet that most people would not even know about it? If the Russian Revolution was truly a revolution led by Jews rather than Marxist Russians, why was such an enormous historical fact ignored in our history books and in our popular media. Furthermore, I could not understand why wealthy and powerful capitalist Jews would foster race mixing and communism. Father had often talked to me about the evils of communism, and I had been thoroughly anti-communist since reading books such as The Conscience of a Conservative by Barry Goldwater, None Dare Call It Treason by John Stormer, and You Can Trust the Communist to Be Communist by Frederick Charles Schwartz. These books and others impressed upon me the penetration of communist ideology throughout our society, media, and government. The Cuban Missile Crisis had occurred just 3 years before, and Father's plans to build a fallout shelter were still fresh in my mind. He'd even purchased food and other survival supplies for it. During that period, the idea of nuclear war grew from an abstract idea to concrete anticipation. In the early 1960s, most communities tested their working order of air raid sirens by sounding them daily at noon. Sometimes when we lost track of time in school, the noon air raid sirens went off. We wondered for a moment if the war had actually come upon us. During the Cuban crisis, most American adults rationalized that thermonuclear war would not happen because it must not happen, because the very thought was too monstrous to contemplate. An 11-year-old is much more prone to believe that someone might pull the switch. Years later, the world discovered that we had actually teetered much closer to nuclear war than most Americans had known at the time. The fact that I viewed communists as putting my family in real danger of nuclear incineration contributed greatly to my visceral anti-communist stance. One of the common sense issues mentioned a full-page newspaper article written by Winston Churchill called Zionism versus Bolshevism, A Struggle for the Soul of the Jewish People. The article had originally appeared in the Illustrated Sunday Herald on February 8, 1920. Churchill had maintained that the world's Jews were being torn between an alliance to communism on the one hand and Zionism on the other. Churchill hoped the Jews would adopt Zionism as an alternative to what he called diabolical and sinister Bolshevism. In his well-written article, contemporary with the early years of the Russian Revolution, Churchill described communism as a sinister confederacy of international Jews who have, quote, gripped the Russian people by the hair of their heads and have become practically the undisputed masters of that enormous empire. The article shocked me enough that I had to check its authenticity. It turned out to be genuine. In fact, I found some Jewish references to it, bewailing the fact that Churchill's article gave fodder to the anti-Semites of the world. The following is an excerpt from his amazing article, and I quote, "In violent opposition to all the spear of Jewish effort rise the schemes of the international Jews. The adherents of this sinister confederacy are mostly men reared up among the unhappy populations of countries where the Jews are persecuted on account of their race. Most, if not all, of them have forsaken the faith of their forefathers and divorced from their minds all spiritual hopes of the next world. This movement among the Jews is not new. From the days of Spartacus Weishaupt to those of Karl Marx, and down to Trotsky in Russia, Bela Kun in Hungary, Rosa Luxemburg in Germany, and Emma Goldman in the United States, this worldwide conspiracy for the overthrow of civilization and for the reconstitution of society on the basis of arrested development, of envious malevolence and impossible equality, has been steadily growing. And now at last, this band of extraordinary personalities from the underworld of the great cities of Europe and America have gripped the Russian people by the hair of their heads and have become practically the undisputed masters of this enormous empire. There's no need to exaggerate the part played in the creation of Bolshevism and in the actual bringing about of the Russian Revolution by these international and, for the most part, atheistical Jews." Unquote. As important an historical figure as Churchill was, he was still only one voice. I rationalized that he could simply be wrong about the nature of the Russian Revolution. One of the Common Sense articles I read referred to a series of explosive documents, complete with file numbers, from the National Archives in the United States. So I wrote to my local congressman, F. Edward Hebert, and asked if his office would obtain copies of the files for me. A couple of weeks later, on returning home from school, I found waiting for me a large manila envelope from the congressman. Certified by the seal of the United States of America, the documents were from the National Archives. They concerned intelligence reports from foreign governments and extensive reports from our own intelligence officers in Russia during the time of the early days of the Communist Revolution and the Russian Civil War. The early 1920s were long before the establishment of the OSS and the CIA. The U.S. Army ran our intelligence international network at the time. One of our military intelligence officers in Russia during the revolutionary period was Captain Montgomery Schuyler. He sent back regular reports to the Chief of Staff of the U.S. Army Intelligence Office, who then relayed them to the Secretary of War and to the President of the United States. Reading through the lengthy reports gave me a glimpse into an historical period of which few Americans are aware. They reported horrible massacres of thousands of Russian aristocrats and intelligentsia murdered simply because they could provide effective leadership, opposition to the communists. Many Americans are at least somewhat aware of Stalin's murder of millions. However, many millions also died in the early days of Bolshevism under Lenin and Trotsky. For it was these men who initiated the first mass killings and the creation of the gulags. The reports also stated without equivocation the Jewish nature of the revolution. In one of Schuyler's official reports, declassified in 1958, that's almost 50 years after he wrote and dispatched them, he states, "It's probably unwise to say this loudly in the United States, but the Bolshevik movement is and has been, since its beginning, guided and controlled by Russian Jews of the greasiest type." In quoting the graphic language of this official report, my intention is not to offend. But Schuyler's report says what it says, whether we like it or not. In another report written 4 months later, Captain Schuyler goes on to quote the evidence of Robert Wilton, who then was the chief Russian correspondent of the authoritative London Times. Wilton later went on to pen a number of best-selling books about the revolution, including the widely acclaimed Russia's Agony and the famous book The Last Days of the Romanovs. On June 9, 1919, Schuyler cites Wilton as follows. "A table made up in 1918 by Robert Wilton, correspondent of the London Times in Russia, shows at that time that there were 384 commissars, including two Negroes, 13 Russians, 15 Chinamen, 22 Armenians, and more than 300 Jews. Of the latter number, 264 had come from the United States since the downfall of the imperial government." There was, of course, no reason to impugn the reporting of the Times or Captain Schuyler. I couldn't believe my eyes as I scanned the papers dispersed across the plastic tablecloth on my dining room table. I wondered how it could be possibly true that the Russian Revolution had only 13 ethnic Russians out of 384 members of its top governing body. Churchill's description of gripping the Russian people by the hair of their heads came to life in the pages I received from our own National Archives. Once I started checking out the leads I would glean from my reading, the National Archives kept providing me with the most incredible documents. Not only did our chief intelligence officer write to the President of the United States about the Jewish nature of communism, so did our U.S. ambassador to Russia, David R. Francis. In a January 1918 cable to our government, he reported, quote, "The Bolshevik leaders here, most of whom are Jews and 90% of whom are returned exiles, care little for Russia or any other country, but are internationalists and they are trying to start a worldwide social revolution." That was from David Francis, American ambassador to Russia at the time of the revolution. The National Archives also sent me copies from its files of communications from Scotland Yard and British Intelligence. The Directorate of British Intelligence sent to America and other nations a lengthy report dated July 16, 1919 on Bolshevism around the world. It was called, quote, A Monthly Review of the Progress of Revolutionary Movements Abroad. This lengthy report lists the communist movements in the major nations of the world. The first sentence in the first paragraph on the first page of this British government official report bluntly states that Jews control international communism. Quote, There is now definite evidence that Bolshevism is an international movement controlled by Jews. Unquote. Years later, as a student at Louisiana State University, I took a course entirely devoted to the Russian Revolution. Neither my professor in his lectures nor my textbook, The Soviet Achievement, made any mention of the historical Jewish-Russian conflict and the Jewish domination of the Communist Party. The Jewish role in the Communist Revolution was, however, mentioned in many major Jewish publications, such as the Jewish Encyclopedia and the Universal Jewish Encyclopedia. It astounded me to find them actually boasting about the pivotal role of Jews in the Russian Revolution. They even pointed out the effort of the communist Jews to disguise the Jewish role, a successful effort, for most Gentiles in America and Europe are still unaware of it. And here's a quote. The communist movement and ideology played an important part in Jewish life, particularly in the 1920s, 30s, and during and after World War II. Individual Jews played an important role in the early stages of Bolshevism and the Soviet regime. The great attraction of communism among Russian and later also Western Jewry emerged only with the establishment of the Soviet regime in Russia. Many Jews the world over, therefore, regarded the Soviet concept of the solution to the Jewish question as an intrinsically positive approach. Communism became widespread in virtually all Jewish communities. In some countries, Jews became the leading element in illegal and illegal communist parties, and in some cases were even instructed by the Communist Internationale to change their Jewish-sounding names and pose as non-Jews, in order not to confirm right-wing propaganda that presented communism as an alien Jewish conspiracy. Unquote. Trotsky's book, and that's, again, from one of the Jewish encyclopedias. Again, go to my book, Jewish Supremacism, and you can find the documentation and citation, and you can look up these quotes for yourselves. Trotsky's book, Stalin, written in exile, attempted to show that Stalin had played only an insignificant role in the early days of the communist takeover. Trotsky attempted to illustrate this point by reproducing a postcard widely circulated in the months following the revolution. The postcard depicted the six leaders of the revolution. Shown are Lenin, who was at least one quarter Jewish, spoke Yiddish in his home, and was married to a Jewess. Trotsky, real name Lev Bronstein. Zinoviev, real name Hirsch Apfelbaum, Lunacharsky, a Gentile, Kamenov, real Jewish name Rosenfeld, and Sverdlov, Jewish. Not only does the postcard show the Jewish domination of the revolution, it also illustrates the fact that the communist Jewish leaders shown had changed their names, presumably to disguise the fact that they were Jews, just as reported in the Encyclopedia Judaica. Although the fact of Lenin's Jewish ancestry was kept quiet for many years, Jewish writers are now taking note of it. David Shub, author of Lenin, a biography, stated in a letter to the Russian immigrant paper Neue Journal that Lenin's mother was Jewish, at least on her father's side, and probably so on her mother's side as well. In addition, a French Jewish periodical, Revue des Fonds Social Youth, reported that a Soviet novelist, Marietta Shagunian, was prevented by Soviet censorship from publishing evidence of Lenin's Jewish ancestry. A number of Jewish publications in recent years have disclosed Lenin's Jewish heritage, including the Jewish Chronicle. I have in the book a facsimile from the Jewish Chronicle, July 26, 1991. The headline is Moscow Magazine on Lenin's Jewish Roots. The Cheka, or secret police, had a Jew, Moses Yuritsky, as its first chief. Most of the other subsequent leaders were also Jews, including Sverdlov and Gingrich Yagoda, which is Russian for Yehuda, the Jew, who presided over the programs that killed millions of Christians. The Soviet propaganda minister during the war was a Jew, Ilya Ehrenberg, who notoriously distinguished himself by his Second World War exhortations to Soviet troops to rape and murder the women and children of Germany. Anatole Goldberg quoted Ehrenberg in his book Ilya Ehrenberg as saying, quote, "The Germans are not human beings. Nothing gives us so much joy as German corpses," unquote. The Communist Secret Police, which underwent many name changes, including Cheka, OGPU, GPU, NKVD, NKGB, MGB, and KGB, was the most feared police agency in the history of the world. They imprisoned, tortured, or murdered more than 30 million Russians and East Europeans. Even the more conservative Soviet historians of the 1960s were placing the number of murdered at about 20 to 40 million, figures that do not include the millions more who were dispossessed, imprisoned, exiled, tortured, and displaced. Nobel Prize winner Alexander Solzhenitsyn, in his opus, The Gulag Archipelago, using the research of a Soviet statistician who had access to secret government files, I.A. Kurganov, estimated that between 1918 and 1959, at least 66 million died at the hands of the communist rulers of Russia. Although that number may be far too high, in Gulag Archipelago II, Solzhenitsyn affirms that Jews created and administered the organized Soviet concentration camp system in which tens of millions of Christians died. Pictured on page 79 of Gulag Archipelago II are the leading administrators of the greatest killing machine in the history of the world. They are Aaron Soltz, Yakov Rapoport, Lazar Kogan, Matvei Berman, Gingrich Yagoda, and Naftali Frankel. All six are Jews. Interestingly enough, during this period of murder and mayhem, Jews were a protected class, so much so that the Communist Party took the unprecedented step of making expressions of anti-Semitism a counter-revolutionary offense and thus punishable by death. A Jewish Voice in January 1942 stated, quote, "The Jewish people will never forget that the Soviet Union was the first country and is yet the only country in the world in which anti-Semitism is a crime." The Congress Bulletin, publication of the American Jewish Congress, stated, "Anti-Semitism was classed as counter-revolution, and the severe punishments meted out for acts of anti-Semitism were the means by which the existing order protected its own safety." I ought to quote that one again. "Anti-Semitism was classed as counter-revolution, and the severe punishments meted out for the acts of anti-Semitism were the means by which the existing order protected its own safety." That's from a publication of the American Jewish Congress. The Russian Penal Codes of 1922 and 27 even went so far as to make anti-Semitism punishable by death. The book Soviet Russia and the Jews by Gregor Aronson, and published by the American Jewish League Against Communism, quotes Stalin remarking on the policy in an interview in 1931 with the Jewish Telegraph Agency. Quote, "Communists cannot be anything but outspoken enemies of anti-Semitism. We fight anti-Semites by the strongest methods in the Soviet Union. Active anti-Semites are punished by death under law." The next section is the beginning of an ethnic war. In school, I brought up these fascinating facts with some of my teachers. They, in turn, were as incredulous as I had been. One suggested that the Jewish involvement in the Communist Revolution might have been the result of a long-running historical persecution of Jews by the Tsars, and indeed by much of the Russian intelligentsia. For instance, Tolstoy, Dostoevsky, and many other prominent Russian writers had criticized Jewish machinations in their books and articles. Russians didn't like the fact that Jews used the Russian language for doing business among Gentiles, but spoke Yiddish among themselves. Jews were accused of having an us versus them mentality rather than assimilating with the Christian majority. There had been a running feud between the Russians and the Jews for centuries, and from these conflicts arose pogroms to suppress the Jews. This war without borders can be illustrated by the Jewish reaction in the 1980s to the anti-Semitic Russian May Laws. The May Laws of 1882 attempted to restrict Jews from some professions and mandate resettlement of most Jews to their original area of the empire, the Pale of Settlement. A huge area originally set up in 1772, encompassing an area about half the size of Western Europe, extending from the Crimea to the Baltic Sea, in which the Jews had been restricted. In retaliation, Jewish international financiers did their best to destroy the Russian economy. Encyclopedia Britannica describes what happened. The Russian May Laws were the most conspicuous legislative monument achieved by modern anti-Semitism. Their immediate result was the ruinous commercial depression which was felt all over the empire and which profoundly affected the national credit. The Russian minister was at his wits' end for money. Negotiations for a large loan were entered upon with the House of Rothschild, and a preliminary contract was signed when the finance minister was informed that unless the persecutions of the Jews were stopped, the great banking house would be compelled to withdraw from the operation. In response to the economic and other pressures put upon Russia, the Tsar issued an edict on September 3, 1882. In it, he stated, "For some time, the government has given its attention to the Jews and to their relations to the rest of the inhabitants of the empire, with a view of ascertaining the sad condition of the Christian inhabitants brought about by the conduct of Jews in business matters. With few exceptions, they have as a body devoted their attention not to enriching or benefiting the country, but to defrauding by their wiles its inhabitants, and particularly its poor inhabitants. This conduct of theirs has called forth protests on the part of the people. Thought it a matter of urgency and justice to adopt stringent measures in order to put an end to the oppression practiced by the Jews on the inhabitants and to free the country from their malpractices, which were, as is known, the cause of the agitations." Unquote. So you see, Jews had ample reason to attempt to overturn the Tsarist government of Russia. And there is direct evidence that they did just that. The Jewish Communal Register of New York City of 1917 and 18, edited and published by the Jewish community, profiles Jacob Schiff, who at that time was one of the wealthiest men in the world, as head of the huge banking house of Kuhn, Loeb and Company. In the article states how the firm of Kuhn, Loeb and Company floated the large Japanese war loans of 1904-1905, thus making possible the Japanese victory over Russia. It goes on to say, "Mr. Schiff has always used his wealth and his influence in the basic interests of his people. He financed the enemies of the autocratic Russian Empire and used his financial influence to keep Russia away from the money market of the United States." Jacob Schiff actually gave somewhere between $17 million and $24 million to finance the Jewish communist revolutionaries in Russia, a sum that would be the equivalent of many hundreds of millions of dollars of today's dollar value. Rabbi Marvin S. Andelman, in his book, To Eliminate the Opiate, cites two sources documenting Schiff's financial support of the communist revolution and ultimate repayment by them. Jacob Schiff is credited with giving $20 million to the Bolshevik Revolution. A year after his death, the Bolsheviks deposited over 600 million rubles to Schiff's banking firm, Kuhn and Loeb. Unquote. It puzzled me that the violently anti-capitalist Communist Party would be supported by some of the most prominent capitalists in the world. But I finally realized that the Russian Revolution was not ultimately about the triumph of an economic ideology. It was about the culmination of an age-old struggle between two powerful peoples, the Jews and the Russians, in an ethnic war that tragically ended in the totalitarian tyranny of the communist dictatorship. Even worse, the score was ultimately settled in the terror of the blood-washed cellars of the Cheka and the frozen death of the gulags. The fact that supercapitalists such as Jacob Schiff could support a nakedly socialist regime such as communism made me question whether there was something more to communism than met the eye. What was it about communism that made it so attractive to Jews who were largely well-educated, non-proletarians, when communism was supposed to be, in Lenin's words, a, quote, dictatorship of the proletariat? Obviously, by and large, Jews were nothing like Marx's workers of the world, for no group was more involved in capitalism or the manipulation and use of capital than the Jewish community. I checked out the communist personalities that Maddie Smith told me were in the Jewish who's who in world Jewry, atheist Leon Trotsky, as well as atheist Maxim Litvinov, the Soviet Minister of Foreign Affairs, are proudly listed in the directory of famous Jews compiled by the leading Jewish rabbinical groups of the world. Winston Churchill, in his eloquent article, Zionism versus Bolshevism, A Struggle for the Soul of the Jewish People, had argued that communism and Zionism were distinct ideologies that were competing, as he put it, for the soul of the Jewish people. But something didn't seem quite kosher in the supposed titanic struggle, for it appeared that many Zionists also supported communism, and at least in the early years, many communists were sympathetic to Zionists. Millions of Jews, even supercapitalists such as Jacob Schiff, supported the communist revolution in Russia. The struggle seemed to be like that of two brothers who might sometimes argue between themselves, but who always stand together against their common enemies. In 1975, I read a book called Trotsky and the Jews, written by Joseph Medava and published by the Jewish Publication Society, Philadelphia, 1971. The book points out that before the Russian Revolution, Leon Trotsky, born Lev Bronstein, used to play chess with Baron Rothschild of the famous Rothschild banking family. Quote, a Jewish journalist, M. Waldman, who knew Trotsky from the period of his stay in Vienna, when he used to play chess with Baron Rothschild in Café Centra and frequent Café Daily to read the press there. What could the Rothschilds, the biggest banking house in Europe, possibly have in common with a leader who wanted to destroy capitalism and private property? Conversely, why would a dedicated communist be a close friend of the most powerful capitalist oppressor in the world? Could it be that they saw communism and Zionism as two very different avenues to a similar goal of power and revenge against the czars? A number of questions arose. Could communism simply have been a tool they adapted to defeat and rule their Russian antagonists? Did the Jews believe they were in conflict with only Russians or with other peoples of the world as well? Was communism originally part of a strategic imperative that reached far beyond the confines of Soviet Russia? These were important questions. I thought that I might find their answers in the philosophical origins of communism. I resolved to investigate the ideological roots of communism. I found Das Kapital and the Communist Manifesto in my public library. Karl Marx's books were obtuse, especially the parts describing the Hegelian dialectic, but they made some sense if one believed that mankind had a machine-like nature as Marx theorized. One of my teachers made the oft-repeated, poorly thought-out comment that communism was great in theory but faulty in practice. To my way of thinking, to be a great idea, it must work in practice, and communism obviously doesn't. There has never been a theory that has promised more human happiness, yet delivered more poverty, mental and physical oppression, and more human misery and death. Until I looked into the foundations of communism, I'd always thought that Karl Marx was a German. In fact, I read that Marx's father was a Christian. Well, it turns out that his father, a successful lawyer, was a Jew who had converted to Christianity after an edict prohibited Jews from practicing law. Much later, in 1977, I read an article from the Chicago Jewish Sentinel boasting that Marx was the grandson of a rabbi and the descendant of Talmudic scholars for many generations. An excellent article in the Barnes Review points out the racism of Marx and Engels. Not only was Karl Marx from a long line of Talmudic scholars, he also hated Russians with a passion that could be described as pathological. I looked up Karl Marx in the Jewish encyclopedias, and I found to my amazement that the man who taught him many of the principles of communism was Moses Hess. As incredible as it might seem, contemporary Zionist leaders venerate Moses Hess as the forerunner of modern Zionism. The Encyclopedia of Zionism in Israel under the entry for Moses Hess is the following. Pioneer of modern socialism, social philosopher, and forerunner of Zionism, Hess was thus a forerunner of political and cultural Zionism and of socialist Zionism in particular. He became deeply involved in the rising socialist movement. Karl Marx and Friedrich Engels acknowledge that they had learned much from him during the formative years of the movement. The Encyclopedia of Zionism in Israel, unquote. After months of reading from many major first-hand sources, I realized that the elderly lady at the offices of the Citizens Council had been essentially right, at least about the origins of the Communist Revolution. I felt as if I were sitting on the edge of a volcano. Every new piece of information seemed to both confirm and clarify the issue even further. In the last days of the Romanovs, Robert Wilton, on assignment for the London Times in Russia for 17 years, summed up the Russian Revolution in these words. The whole record of the Bolshevik Revolution in Russia is indelibly impressed with the stamp of an alien invasion. The murder of the Tsar, deliberately planned by the Jew Sverdlov and carried out by the Jews Goloshekin, Smoloftov, Safarov, Voykov, and Yurovsky, is the act not of the Russian people, but of this hostile invader. In 1990, a major Jewish New York publisher, the Free Press, a division of Simon & Schuster, published a book by Israeli historian Louis Rappaport called Stalin's War Against the Jews. In it, the author casually admits what we Gentiles are not supposed to know. Quote, many Jews were euphoric over their high representation in the new government. Lenin's first Politburo was dominated by men of Jewish origins. Also, under Lenin, Jews became involved in all aspects of the revolution, including its dirtiest work. Despite the communist vow to eradicate anti-Semitism, it spread rapidly after the revolution, partly because of the prominence of so many Jews in the Soviet administration, as well as in the traumatic and human Sovietization drives that followed. Historian Salo Baron has noted that an immensely disproportionate number of Jews joined the new Soviet secret police, the Cheka, and many of those who fell afoul of the Cheka would be shot by Jewish investigators. The collective leadership that emerged in Lenin's dying days was headed by the Jew Zinoviev, a loquacious, curly-headed, etc., etc. I began to realize that there was once widespread knowledge of the Jewish leadership of the Russian Revolution. An example of that can be found in the National Geographic's magazine of May 1907 edition. An article entitled The Revolution in Russia describes the Jewish leadership of the terroristic communist revolution. Quote, the revolutionary leaders nearly all belong to the Jewish race, and the most effective revolutionary agency is the Jewish Bund. The government has suffered more from that race than from all of its other subjects combined. Whenever a desperate deed is committed by it, it's always done by a Jew, and there's scarcely one loyal member of that race in the entire empire. Unquote. The facts were indisputable. An enormous fact of history has been wiped away from the intellectual consciousness of the West as thoroughly as a file can be erased from the hard disk of a desktop computer. In his classic novel, 1984, George Orwell wrote about historical truth going down the memory hole. This has been the fate of the truth regarding the real perpetrators of the Russian Revolution. I ask myself two questions. Why was the historical truth about the Communist Revolution suppressed? And how, in the free world, could that suppression have been accomplished? The first question had an obvious answer in the fact that the forces of international Jewry would not want it generally known that they were the primary authors of the most repressive and murderous evil in the history of mankind, communism. Obviously, knowledge of that fact does not create good public relations for Jews. The answer to the second question of how was more elusive. I realized that only very powerful forces could suppress important parts of the historical record and create a false impression of a, quote, Russian, unquote, revolution, when there were only 13 ethnic Russians in the highest levels of the first Bolshevik government. Obviously, the Jews historically did have a lot of power, as evidenced by Jacob Schiff, the Rothschilds, and others. But the power to change the perception of history, that seemed preposterous. Yet only a few months before, when Maddie Smith had told me at the Citizens Council that the Russian Revolution was Jewish, I had thought the idea was ridiculous. Now I knew differently. And I knew I was just beginning to discover a different reality in the world that was not mentioned by the New York Times. The facts I knew then led me to some interesting new questions. Does it make me an anti-Semite to accept the historical fact that the Russian Revolution was not actually Russian, but a takeover of Tsarist Russia by an antagonistic non-Russian nationality? Is there a historically proven nationalism among Jews hostile toward other peoples? Do Jewish interests and the interests of the Christian West synchronize or conflict? If those interests sometimes conflict, did the well-coordinated worldwide Jewish effort to fiercely fight for their perceived ethnic interests in Russia have negative ramifications for Russia, Western Europe, and America? How did Jewish organized power create our special relationship with Israel in modern times? And finally, did asking these questions have anything to do with, quote, hate, unquote? When I saw programs on television about anti-Semitism, hate was almost always the word used to describe any negative opinion about Jews. I felt no hatred toward Jews. My investigation had been purely an intellectual exercise. I was an interloper looking into a world where I did not belong. But it was a world that intrigued me. Pondering the hate question, I asked a teacher at school why the word hate wasn't ever used by the media to describe the motivation of the mass murder of millions of Russian Christians in the Soviet Union. Certainly it would have taken a great deal of hate to have committed such monstrous crimes. She had no answer, and yet I had many more questions. In later years, I learned that labeling such inquiries hate was itself part of an organized effort to demonize anyone who would dare to oppose Jewish supremacist hatred of the Gentile world. Once I discovered the shared roots of both communism and Zionism, I decided to examine the history of the Jewish people, both historical Judaism and the development of modern Zionism. I felt that I had access to the best sources in the world for my investigation. I started with three excellent and exhaustive Jewish encyclopedias.
The next chapter is chapter 15, The Roots of Jewish Supremacism.